Christ and the Disciples, July 26, 1899, typed. When Jesus came into the coasts of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, saying, "Whom do men say that I, the Son of Man, am?" And they said, "Some say that thou art John the Baptist, some Elias, and others Jeremias, or one of the prophets." Matthew 16, verse 13-14. Centuries before, Isaiah had written, "Listen, O isles, unto me, and hearken, ye people from far. The Lord hath called me from the womb. From the bowels of my mother hath he made mention of my name, and he hath made my mouth like a sharp sword. In the shadow of his hand hath he hid me, and made me a polished shaft. In his quiver hath he hid me, and said unto me, Thou art my servant, O Israel, in whom I will be glorified." Isaiah 49, verse 1-3. Christ came to elevate his people, to make them co-workers with him, that they might be a light to the Gentiles. He sought to draw them to him, working miracles before them, raising the dead, and healing all manner of disease. He presented truth that led them to say, "Never man spake like this man." John 7, verse 46. But they rejected him and despised his love. His language regarding his labor for Israel was, "I have labored in vain. I have spent my strength for naught and in vain. Yet surely my judgment is with the Lord, and my work with my God. Though Israel be not gathered, yet shall I be glorious in the eyes of the Lord, and my God shall be my strength. Thus saith the Lord, In an acceptable time have I heard thee, and in a day of salvation have I helped thee, and I will preserve thee, and give thee for a covenant of the people, to establish the earth, to cause to inherit the desolate heritages, that thou mayest say to the prisoners, Go forth, to them that are in darkness, show yourselves. They shall feed in the ways, and their pastures shall be in all high places. They shall not hunger nor thirst, neither shall the heat nor sun smite them. For he that hath mercy on them shall lead them, even by the springs of water shall he guide them. And I will make all my mountains a way, and my highways shall be exalted. Behold, these shall come from far, and lo, these from the north and from the west, and these from the land of Sinim." Isaiah 49, verse 4, 5, 8-12. "But whom say ye that I am?" Christ asked the disciples. And Simon Peter answered, "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." Matthew 16, verse 15-16. Peter did not speak these words in an ordinary tone, but with inspired fervor, as if he indeed beheld the glory of Christ. He expressed the sentiments of the other disciples, but he was the only one who was at this time inspired to put his faith into words. Peter might have said, "The learned teachers, the scribes and Pharisees, the ruler of the people, are perplexed over this subject, and shall we, unlettered fishermen, venture to decide the question?" But Peter felt the glory of God shining into his soul. His heart burned with him. He could not keep silent, and in language of adoration said, "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." It was as though the veil were removed, and God, who commanded the light to shine out of darkness, was shining into the hearts of the disciples to give them the light of his knowledge. And Jesus answered and said unto him, "Blessed art thou, Simon Bar-Jona, for flesh and blood hath not revealed it unto thee, but my Father which is in heaven. And I say also unto thee, that thou art Peter, and upon this rock, the Son of the living God, I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." Verses 17-18. The church was not built upon Peter, for the gates of hell did prevail against him. He denied his Lord with cursing and swearing. It is built upon one against whom the gates of hell cannot prevail. "And I will give unto thee the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatsoever thou shalt bind in earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatsoever thou shalt loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." Then charged he his disciples that they should tell no man that he was Jesus the Christ. Verses 19-20. This charge was given because of the determined opposition of the scribes and Pharisees. From that time forth began Jesus to show unto his disciples how that he must go unto Jerusalem, and suffer many things of the elders and chief priests and scribes, and be killed, and be raised again the third day. Then Peter took him, and began to rebuke him, saying, Be it far from thee, Lord, this shall not be unto thee. Verses 21-22. Peter had just been told that his acknowledgment of Jesus as the Son of God was inspired from above, and it was a great shock to him to be told of Christ's approaching suffering and death. The Son of God to be thus treated? Peter was filled with opposition. His whole being rose up against the thought. Be it far from thee, Lord, he said vehemently. This shall not be unto thee. The words of commendation spoken to Peter were quickly followed by a stern rebuke. Christ turned to him, saying, Get thee behind me, Satan, for thou savorest not the things that be of God, but the things that be of men. Mark 8, verse 33. Peter's first words had been inspired by God, but in denying that Christ would suffer an idol, he was giving voice to Satan's suggestions, and Christ's rebuke was addressed to Satan, who was tempting Peter to contradict. After this reproof, no more was said on the subject. All were silent. A dense cloud seemed to gather over the souls of the disciples. Jesus saw that he must give them evidence of his relationship with God. He saw the effect that his words had had on them, and he looked forward to the time when these words should be fulfilled, when the disciples should forsake him. He was indeed alone in the world, for even his chosen companions could not understand his words. He must gain a fresh hold on omnipotence, for only thus could he contemplate the future. This help had been promised him, but he must receive it by faith. Christ had asked the disciples what the people thought of him, not because he did not know their thoughts, but that the disciples might have an opportunity of confessing him, and thus be strengthened for the coming trial. How he longed that the faith they then expressed might remain firm through his suffering, humiliation, abuse, and, as his persecutors thought, degradation. But no human power could degrade Christ, for his godlikeness would appear in every scene of humiliation, and would flash conviction even into the hearts of priests and rulers. Never, never would the memory of these scenes be effaced from their minds. Christ began to tell his disciples what was coming upon him, that they might be prepared for the future. But they were so pained by his words that he could go no farther. Their master to be formally rejected, to be tried for his life? Their divine teacher to be crucified, made to suffer the most painful death that human beings can suffer, a death inflicted only on those most deeply dyed with crime? Christ is now far out of the reach of Herod and Caiaphas, the disciples reasoned. He has nothing to fear from the hatred of the Jews or from the power of the Romans. Why need he to go to Jerusalem and give himself up to death? To the disciples, this was indeed a mystery. They did not realize that this sacrifice was appointed from the foundation of the earth, and that it must be offered, else no son or daughter of Adam could be saved. But what made Christ's words concerning his death still more mysterious to them was the fact that they were spoken immediately after his assurance that he was the Son of the living God. If he was to die, how was it that his kingdom was to be established so firmly that the gates of hell should not prevail against it? He had commended Peter for his belief in his divinity, and had assured him that God had led him to make this acknowledgment. He had accepted the title of Son of God, and now he declares that he must go to Jerusalem to be insulted by the scribes and Pharisees and tormented to death on the shameful cross. How could this be? The lack of faith shown by the disciples grieved the Savior. Could they bear the crisis, the terrible test? He desired to lead them to see that his death was necessary for his own glory, for the glory of the Father. It was necessary also in order that the human race might be partakers with him in that glory. Christ saw that he must give his disciples a symbol of his kingdom. His mission would then be more clearly understood. Letting them pass on before him, he knelt before God in prayer, soliciting special help, that he might withstand the temptations that were continually urging themselves upon him. But his greatest care was for his disciples, who even while he was praying were reasoning together over what he had told them of the future. Why need the Master put himself in danger? They were asking. Why need he go to Jerusalem, where were his bitterest enemies? Why not work here, at a distance from the Pharisees? The course that Christ was about to follow looked to them like presumption. Christ knew their grief and perplexity, and he prayed that God would give them a visible token of his divinity, that they might be strengthened to believe that he was all he claimed to be.